I'm recording a live show, and I'd love to have you there. It's going to be for a follow-up episode to this pan-political series, where I'll be putting out some additional content and responding to some feedback that I've received, including your questions and comments on the day. It'll be somewhere between a workshop and a presentation, meaning you'll have the opportunity to chat with other listeners about your thoughts in the series, and it'll be a bit interactive. It'll be a nice, chilled-out way to hang out with me and some other interesting listeners for a couple of hours. It'll be by Zoom, so you don't even need to leave home, on the morning of Saturday the 5th of July 2025 in Australia time, which is the evening of Friday the 4th of July in US time. It's really cheap, around 15 or 20 bucks, and even cheaper if you're a Patreon member. Links are in the show notes for this live recording and also on the Curious Creatures website. Like I say, I'd love to see you there and to meet you. Hey folks, you're listening to a special nine-part series on gender, gender politics and gender equality. Obviously, you can do what you'd like in terms of how you listen to them, but I've designed these to be listened to in order. Each episode builds on the last one in a logical way. Think of it like you'd think of a book. If you take things out of order, a lot of it is going to be hard to understand or just seem off. So if you've just stumbled into this episode, please go back to the start. Otherwise, thanks for listening to everything in order. Let's get into it. For today, welcome to the end. Just a bit of a heads up that some of this is our usual chatty style and probably the bits towards the end might feel a little bit more like a monologue, but we have all the time and space in the world to then get into things. But some of it sounds a bit like a TED talk. And from there, we are going to finish on a big fat note of hope. To get there, let's start with a little bit of history. So I'm going to zoom out a little bit and go back to where we were in the West in the 1950s. So we had come out of the wars and we'd come out of the Great Depression and we were just in the middle of, or just had, the Industrial Revolution, and we found ourselves with, relatively speaking, lots of time and money. And as a sort of a flow-on effect from that, we found ourselves with lots of time to reflect and contemplate. At that point in time, our gender roles still matched what I've referred to in this series as our inheritance, as in what we've inherited from the last million years. So in terms of what we looked like in the outside world, women were more involved with family, more likely to be carers, only just got the right to vote, and were in the process of getting access to education and work, and therefore career and so forth, and all the independence and financial stuff that comes with it. Men were outside the home, they were workers, and just outside of the war mentality, conscription and fighting for your country and so forth. As far as our internal landscape was concerned, women were more socialized in the way of emotional and communication skills. They were more connected with the ability to be vulnerable and to come together and to recognize needs and disadvantages and to articulate those needs. And in terms of their internal landscape, men were kind of the opposite of that. So their role was still to shut up and get on with it and pretend that there weren't problems, and to also see that having a weakness was a weakness. So that's kind of where we were at, more or less, in the 1950s. So it's an interesting thought experiment, given that background basis. If things were the same between, let's just talk about two genders, if you imagine that things were the same on some level, and I don't mean the exact privileges and advantages and disadvantages were the same, but say it was possible to measure that we were approximately similarly well or not well off. The socialization that women received would have meant that from that starting point, we would have only really heard about women's issues. By which I mean, men simply didn't start with the skills to be able to recognize that they had needs or to articulate their problems and they wouldn't have received positive feedback and support for that, which is not to say it was a walk in the park for women, but it would have been easier for women to come together and articulate their needs than it would have been for men. And that's pretty much exactly what's unfolded over the last 70-odd years. So while men are still everywhere in culture, politics, society, television, media, etc., men's issues are pretty rare. Women are a little less visible, but women's issues much more visible. Is this making sense so far?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, sense in a horrible kind of way.
So it could be because there are no men's issues, and I think it's true that a lot of people think that that's the case, and that sort of does become a little bit self-fulfilling. But it may also be that emotionality, vulnerability, the ability to collaborate and the ability to articulate, they are actually superpowers and they pattern everything that happened going forwards from the 1950s. I put to you that men simply couldn't keep up and are still nowhere close in terms of those skills, doing those things. On top of that, the way things generally play out, the way these conversations generally play out, we're still in the process of keeping those issues at bay, like for the reasons we spoke about on the last episode. A lot of us see gender issues as a zero-sum game, meaning we either look at one side or the other, and there's a sense that if we look at the other side, then that detracts from the side that we really believe in, as opposed to thinking, which sort of says that a rising tide floats all boats. We also pretty actively define having any interest in men's issues or speaking up about them as a form of misogyny in itself. So we're pretty actively keeping that male vulnerability at bay at the moment. How are we going? Still good?
Well, still sad, yeah.
Still sad. Thank you. I'd like to talk now about evolution versus revolution. So they're very different things. Revolution comes from the word revolve. So things revolve. They go round and round and round again. Evolution, on the other hand, is when things evolve. So when they change. Revolutions often feel like change, but on some level, they're just repeating the same cycles or similar cycles over and over. So you see this a lot in adversarial government systems. So Australia and America are really obvious examples where you've got a sort of a theoretically more liberal government and a theoretically more whatever the other is, conservative, let's say, government. And it's hilarious because every election, governments always say, it's time for change. We need newness, we need change. And then they get in and just do exactly the same stuff, all of it, exactly over again. There is almost no change in Western governments, on at least on some levels. You also see this pattern play out in the example, say, of like military coups. So a military dictatorship or a military coup will happen if it's felt that the government is being irresponsible, and they'll come in with the promise of, right, we need to force change. And then things get comfortable and that refreshing military coup just turns out to be exactly the same things repeated over again. So all of those things are revolutions. They're just the same pattern repeating over and over and over again, as opposed to evolution. And not a lot changes. So when it comes to gender politics, feminism is in some ways an evolution, but in some ways it is just a revolution. So obviously the women's movement has been a radical and much needed change around things like women's rights, the right to vote, the right to work, access to education, finances, public voice and public faces, safety, and so forth and so forth and so forth. So many, like all of those issues, absolutely crucial, absolutely needed, and the women's movement has been stunning and profound in its capacity to shift those issues. At the same time, there are some things that the movement actually has in common with what it is seeking to replace, which is obviously patriarchy, let's say. The things that both movements have in common is that both sides mostly just look after their own gender and their issues. Both sides actively resist and suppress knowledge of the other side's issues. And both sides seek to focus on sex or gender differences and to celebrate those differences rather than focus on what we have in common. They're sort of separatist movements in a lot of ways. And they see women and men, heaven forbid minority genders, as different. So in some ways, feminism is a repetition of what it seeks to replace. But even worse than that, in some ways, feminism has picked up on two unhealthy aspects of what the patriarchy left us with, and it's made them even worse. It's actually exaggerated them. So the first one is that toxic masculinity actually turned out to be very convenient for keeping men's issues out of the way so that they don't get in the way of focusing on women's issues. So men that are not able to realize that they need help, not able to be vulnerable, not able to speak up for their needs, that's been incredibly convenient in some ways for feminism to achieve its goals. You could almost say that patriarchy laid the foundations for toxic masculinity and feminism built a house on top of that. The second thing is that, ironically, feminism has actually taken on patriarchy's values around what things, and I guess I'm talking about what privileges, are actually important. So feminism has placed a huge amount of focus and value on what I would regard as social and structural privileges. So men have huge structural and social privilege. They can wander into organizations, they can wander into positions of power in society, and all those sorts of things. And feminism has sort of looked at those things and agreed and gone, yes, those things are important. And it has, we have as feminists, we have undervalued the socialization that women generally receive, which is more to do with psychological ones. And not only have we undervalued them, but we actually regard that as sort of emotional labor that women do on behalf of men, which is radically different to saying, wow, they are privileges. We've been given incredible privileges in that area and we actually need to share them. So yeah, when we look at the world that way, when we say men have got all of the privileges and women have none, we're actually just taking on patriarchy's value system.
We're weaponizing some of that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So in terms of like circling right back to the start where I had those recordings and I spoke about progress has been made in some areas and not in other areas, I think the areas where feminism has accidentally repeated patriarchy's mistakes, they are the areas where we are making no progress. So I think because of the fact that in some ways, in a lot of ways, we're rebirthing toxic masculinity and reinforcing that. And we're not placing value on those psychological and social sort of skills that on average women may be more likely to have. They are the things that are setting up the next generation of violence from men and the next generation of lack of awareness and lack of sensitivity. I'm running a course called A Therapist's Guide to Sexuality, Taboos and Kink with Process Work International. It's designed with therapists in mind, by which I mean any one-to-one practitioner who wants to know more about the world of sexuality so as to be able to better support your clients that are exploring that world. It'll tackle a whole bunch of juicy topics like how to pick positively and therapeutically beneficial forms of play from ones that might be damaging or concerning. It addresses why people pursue these areas of interest in the first place, and what you can do to support them towards safe and well-paced experimentation, even if you yourself have got little or no interest in such things. The course is pitched at therapists of various descriptions, but will also be of relevance to people seeking a solid grounding in best practice exploration of their sexuality. It runs for 3 2-hour sessions by Zoom, starting on September the 9th, 2025. Links are in the show notes, and also on the Curious Creatures website. Love to see you there. I'm recording a live show, and I'd love to have you there. It's going to be for a follow-up episode to this pan-political series, where I'll be putting out some additional content and responding to some feedback that I've received, including your questions and comments on the day. It'll be somewhere between a workshop and a presentation, meaning you'll have the opportunity to chat with other listeners about your thoughts in the series, and it'll be a bit interactive. It'll be a nice, chilled out way to hang out with me and some other interesting listeners for a couple of hours. It'll be by Zoom, so you don't even need to leave home, on the morning of Saturday the 5th of July 2025 in Australia time, which is the evening of Friday the 4th of July in US time. It's really cheap, around 15 or 20 bucks, and even cheaper if you're a Patreon member. Links are in the show notes for this live recording and also on the Curious Creatures website. Like I say, I'd love to see you there and to meet you.
With revolutions, the next cycle tends to begin before the last one is complete. So at this point in time, feminism is nowhere near done. We have a lot further to go in terms of feminism meeting its goals. It's nowhere near done, but we already have the backlash. We've had the backlash since at least the 80s. These days, it sort of feels like incels. Maybe it feels like pickup artists. Maybe it feels like the alt-right male pride movement. Maybe it feels like men's rights. I'm not saying that in the same way that I'm definitely not saying that all of feminism is problematic. That's a long way from what I'm saying. I'm also not saying that all of the men's movement is problematic, but I'm definitely saying that some of it is, and that some of it is just a repetition, a revolution of the same sorts of stuff. All of these movements that I've just mentioned, so from patriarchy to feminism and from the various expressions of the reactive men's movement, they all have the same qualities. They're repeating the same things over again. They're revolutions of the same mistakes. How are we going? The next bit is the solution, but are we making sense? Any thoughts, any comments thus far?
I was just thinking seeing that there are issues and problems within all of the movements. I mean, I don't remember whether we've covered this or not before, but a lot of the younger males that I teach, they'll start quoting stuff from Andrew Tate or some other thing. And what is obvious to me is that they're just really desperate for more visibility and more sense of strength and more sense of respect and so on. They sort of missing the mark, and they don't know what that means by sort of going, oh, I'm just going to do what I like. It's like, well, that's not respect and that's not power, but I can see why you're keen for it, because the sense of lack of respect and lack of power and lack of sovereignty is quite apparent in them. And so they're just desperate looking for it. You know, they're hunting, going, all right, where can I get that? And here's these guys like Andrew Tate who are just going, oh, you know, grab it however you want or whatever. Like, I don't know. I actually haven't listened to anything that Andrew Tate said, so maybe I should. It'd be interesting. But in the bits that I know about it, sort of go, well, it's really clear, obvious to me why these young guys that I'm teaching are hunting for that, because they just don't have much of a sense of power or sovereignty otherwise.
Yeah. And when the mainstream paradigm is sort of saying to them, you are evil, you are dangerous, you are not to
be
trusted,
problem.
You are a problem, you are a predator, or even you owe us for what other people like you have done to us,
Then
you can see, and I'm the same as you, Emma, I have not listened to any Andrew Tate that I'm aware of, but you can imagine any perspective that says, no, you're important, you matter, you're welcome over here, we're not going to say those bad things about you.
Yeah. I do specifically know, like, the boys in the class will go, oh, Andrew Tate, blah, blah. So they are specifically talking about him. So I'm not imagining that they're getting this info from somewhere else. They specifically will say, oh, but have you heard what he said? And I say, well, no, I haven't. But I'd love for you to think about whether it's going to do you good in the long run. And they get a little bit perplexed. And I said, I think it's great. If we're all learning how to be more powerful and more, you know, in our power as humans, that's great. And they're sort of looking at me like I'm a bit too much of a hippie. But
yeah. Just for fun and giggles, when women quote the female equivalent of Andrew Tate, and there are many out there, I'm not going to name them, but there are many out there, would you say the same thing to them?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't know what they would have said, but yeah, I would definitely say, oh, I think it's good if we're finding our own power and sovereignty. Yeah, I would say that to the female students, but I've not heard any of them say anything that's loud or kind of obnoxious in that way. When they do say things like all boys are a-holes or whatever, I'll specifically say, have you met them all? And they're what? I was like, well, have you met all of them? Because if you haven't, then you can't say that they all are. And yeah, that's my sort of circuit breaker.
We're so us and them, aren't we? We're so always this, never that.
Yeah, it's very sad. Such a limiting way to view the world.
So,
I do have a thought, but it might be introducing new material, so feel free to throw it out. Do you think that the focus on this is the way to get ahead and we need to invest in being like a man in a man's world to get ahead, that the core skills of that communication and care and empathy, etc., do you think there is actually less of that because of that? And therefore we're actually losing some of those skills?
I think we are moving towards a more collaborative world. We are just about to talk about this in a much bigger way. Mm-hmm. Think our accidental slipping into going along with patriarchy's value system is slowing our progress. But that's, I don't know about going backwards, but I think it's slowing our progress. But yeah, that's definitely getting into the solution. So let's talk about the solution.
Sure.
Essentially, this is absolutely embarrassing. The message is love everyone. Be informed about all gender issues and simultaneously take the focus off gender. Start seeing ourselves as people rather than as our genders. So all of these things would be evolutions, not revolutions. It is an evolution to care about everyone and to care about everyone's issues. Emmy, you've been talking about looking for squares and circles and so forth. I want to expand on that just a tiny little bit around what happens if we're only looking for one set of inputs. I got to thinking about, there's a called LIGO. It's the laser interferometer experiment where they're looking for the super low frequency gravitational waves that comes from stars colliding in far distant galaxies. And it was theorized that they were out there. And the way we measure them is we set up a station and we send a laser beam off to a mirror like a kilometer away or whatever in two different directions. And then we can measure if those laser beams come back to us with a little bit of a wobble. And when there's a little bit of a wobble, it means that we're picking up what we're looking for. Absolutely brilliant experiment. And we've found many, many such wobbles, way more than we thought we were going to find. Absolutely brilliant. But if the LIGO team were to, they're obviously looking for one very, very, very specific set of data. And if they were to say, this is the only data, this is the only thing that exists in the world, there is no light, there is no heat, there is no radio waves, there is no background noise, all there is occasional very low frequency observations, obviously that would shift very quickly from being brilliant to being stupid.
Okay.
But the parallel there in the context of gender, most of the time we are only looking for examples of how men are bad or how they are the victors in this world and how women are good or how they are the victims. And for most of us, we're quite happy with that, even though as a science experiment, it's just one tiny little signal set. But a lot of the time, I don't think we recognize that. Mm-hmm. And maybe an example of that is that we did a whole episode on the gender pay gap, which I think showed that it's a very confusing event. Just to oversimplify it, most people are aware that there's a trend of women being paid less, but most people are not aware that men are more likely to die on the job and that their jobs are a lot more dangerous and less enjoyable. So for me, those things go together and they make it a little confusing at least, or a little more nuanced around what would you prefer. But yeah, when you're only looking for one set of data, it looks more one-sided. I think what we're engaged in here is a global scale behavior change program where we are trying to change the behavior of men. And you cannot change someone's behavior without having a compassionate understanding of what causes that behavior in the first place. So if we're not even too willing to look at that and look at the background, we stand no chance of changing that behavior. And this comes back to what we spoke about in the first episode of how we deal with the problem of male violence. If the only option we've got is just more policing and harsher prison sentences, we are not actually going to change that situation. Going to make it worse.
How about that capitalism, huh? I want to talk with you about a weird way that capitalism is actually kind of functional. has to do with this podcast. Firstly, I want to stress it's okay for you to just listen to this and not contribute. I say just listen because it's not nothing. By just listening to it, you're engaging with my material, you're probably having chats about it with others, and really, that's all I'm doing this for. I can tell that you are there because I can see you in the total number of downloads, and it means a lot to me. This relationship works for me. It's okay to just listen. At the same time, I know that some of you want to show a more active level of support and are in a position to do so. This is where capitalism comes into it and doesn't actually do a half bad job. I've set up a Patreon page, which, in short, is an easy way for you to contribute. And it's very meaningful to me. I used to be skeptical about paying for podcasts, but eventually I had to ask myself how it differs from paying for books, or for videos, or for workshops, or for therapy, all of which I pay for pretty consistently. And this, my friends, is my version of a book, or a workshop, or a whatever. So I feel okay about asking for a donation through Patreon, if you're in a position to do so, and this has been meaningful for you. So the link is in the show notes and also on the Curious Creatures website. If you're not in a position to contribute, please don't feel guilty about listening to this for free. I appreciate you, and I appreciate having you on this ride with me.
When we're talking about sexuality and sexual orientation, we sometimes use the word pansexual to mean that we are interested in all people, all genders, and you also hear the word pan in relation to, say, pan-continental, which means all countries. I propose that we become pan-political. So for me, what that means is I intend to be well-informed about the issues that affect all genders, and I will go into bat on behalf of all genders. I want to give you a couple of examples of what that, or a couple of parallels around what that might look like in practice. Are you too familiar with the Bechdel test with regards to movies and female content?
I'm not.
It's a rule, I believe it comes from someone with the surname Bechdel in the 70s. And off the top of my head, it asks the question, does the film have at least two female characters that have a conversation about something other than a male? So it addresses the fact that obviously Bechdel and whoever was around them at the time were looking at movies and saying women are just so secondary in this mix. So what is a test that we can run to see if women are actually given legitimate, substantial, valid roles? And I love the test without a shred of a doubt. Probably comes as no surprise that a surprising number of movies fail the test. That for me is a one-sided science experiment though. I think something with a little more nuance, I'm calling it the Bechdel/Butler test. And so in addition to the original Bechdel clause, I am looking at what I think is one of the biggest problems in movies, which is the normalization of violence by men or to men. And so I add, in addition to the Bechdel test, I add the question, is there any physical violence that is portrayed, A, as if it's humorous or not serious, B, as if it was normal or acceptable, or C, as if the recipient in some way deserved the violence? And if not many tests pass the Bechdel test, trust me, almost none pass the Bechdel-Butler test. And it is so good to collaborate with Bechdel on this issue.
It is extremely difficult to find a non-violent, and if you can, there's still quite a lot of angst and the real, like, just people being horrible to each other in really shit situations. Yeah.
And not surprisingly, that winds up being our role modeling subconsciously. Almost like when our parliamentarians scream at each other. It is really hard to find good nonviolent films. So with this Bechdel-Butler test, it's so clearly better for everyone. It's so clearly addressing two problems simultaneously. It's twice as good. But it's quite funny, when I published that about 10 years ago, I got some pretty harsh pushback from people that felt that it was taking away from women's issues and that it was hijacking their medium, which is just so crazy.
Even though there is a buttload of evidence buttload to suggest that violence is also bad for women, and therefore that should be extra good if there's no violence, as well as women there in their own right.
You'd think, wouldn't you?
Sometimes, yeah.
I've got another parallel which relates to what I've been taught as the four stages of conflict. And at the end of this whole series, when the three of us are offline, I'll do a more of a deep dive into giving credit where credit is due and sourcing the sources for some of this material where it's not my own. But this was taught to me as there's four stages that a conflict goes through. The first stage is denial. Second stage, polarization. Third stage, switching. And then lastly, integration. So denial, I might give an example of a conflict in the workplace. Denial, the first stage, is when you're denying that a problem exists. So you've got yourself into a job and you're so excited and enthusiastic about it and you're so keen for it to be your dream job that you ignore the problems that are there up until the point in time where you can no longer avoid them. So the other coworker just becomes intolerable, or the hours become intolerable, or something else snaps and you can no longer stay in denial. At that point in time, you move into polarization, which is when the conflict is really polarized. You're very passionately for or against something, and you're seeing the other side as the other side, and you are in disagreement with the other side, and you think that they're foolish. At polarization. The third stage is, in my world of psychology, called switching, which is where you can start to switch roles a little bit. And for just a little moment, you have a little glimmer and you just go, oh, okay, now maybe I do see why the workplace has got that policy, or maybe I see why my workmate does things that way. I still don't like it. I still think they're wrong, but I can see blah, blah, blah. So that's the beginning of a switching process. And then the last stage is integration, where you've actually managed to have the conversation with them, or maybe you've moved on to a different job. Who knows how it works out? But you actually get to the stage where one way or another, that is no longer an issue. So It's just integrated. It's part of the background noise and you're ready to move on to your next conflict and you're already in denial about that one. So that's the four stages of conflict, which I anyway find to be a really useful model. When we look at where we're at with gender equality and gender politics, stage one, denial of the problem, that may have been the landscape we were in before the 1950s. So before feminism came along and revolutionized everything, that may have been the landscape we were in. Stage two, polarization. I think with some exceptions, that's the stage that we are still in. We are still extremely polarized, and I think we are getting more polarized, if anything, at the moment. And generally speaking, the two sides of the debate, like if we had an angry Andrew Tate in the room and an angry whatever, the pro-feminist female equivalent of that is, we wouldn't get them swapping sides and agreeing with each other all that much at the moment. We're not up to, I mean, some of us as individuals may be up to switching sides, or we may be up to integration, but I think the mainstream debate is not there at the moment. The concept of pan-political jumps us ahead to stage three or four. So in a pan-political world, we don't see the other side's issues as detracting from our own. We see them as essential to solving all of our problems. We realize, for instance, just to go back to that example about male violence, we realize that we're never going to stop violence against women unless we also stop violence against men. Can't have just one side of that. In a pan-political world, we don't just lock onto a side and then attempt to quieten down or cancel the other side. We welcome everyone to the table and we recognize we need to collaborate and hear all voices. We don't obsess about gender or sex differences. So we recognize that there's more diversity within groups than there is between groups. And we see people as individuals rather than as their genders. We recognize that if we know someone's gender, that doesn't actually tell us anything about them. In a pan-political world, we don't ignore our own gender-related trauma, but we also don't let it exclusively drive the way we see the world and the way we assess what's going on, the way we understand the world. And needless to say, we don't humiliate, we don't gaslight, we don't laugh at, we don't shut down, and we don't shut out. A pan-political world doesn't have a gender war. that has a group of people that are working together on gender issues and patterns. It's not two sides working against each other, or three if we lump minority genders in there as one group. I don't think it can be called feminism, because that will always be tied to women's issues and one-sidedness. So I don't know if pan-political is the best name, but it seems like a good start to me. In the past, I've heard this movement referred to as peopleism, and together we might be fighting the Kyriarchy or the Powerarchy as opposed to the Patriarchy. But either way, I identify as pan-political until something better comes along, and I invite you to join me. The great news is that being pan-political works incredibly well. If you care about other people's issues, they will care about yours. I think being pan-political tends to give you hope rather than angry hopelessness. Hope tends to be more empowering. Angry hopelessness tends to be disempowering. And I think the perspective just naturally makes the whole situation more understandable and makes the solutions become more obvious. And it can be as simple as a conversation about who's doing childcare. There's two more bits I want to do. One's on an even bigger perspective, and then lastly, my personal conclusion. But I just want to check in with you two. How we're going with that last rave?
I'm liking it.
I have my thinky brain on.
Mm.
It feels very big.
Yep. How so?
How so? It feels like an uphill battle. And I may be saying that today because I'm slightly depressed about life in general. When I know for a fact that that is how I approach things anyway, with a like, you seem to be having some difficulties. How are they different from mine? Oh, actually, they're pretty similar. How can I help you with that? So I know from a personal level that this is achievable and doable. I also know it seems hard and big because I have to be careful who I tell that I do that to at the moment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. True.
Just noting that it's like, wow, that seems world-changing, because what you're proposing is world-changing. It's just like, ah, it's a bit overwhelming.
I think this is how things begin. And I'm not saying that it's going to be pan-political, and I'm not saying that this particular piece of work is, it's not the starting point. It's one of a million starting points. But yeah.
I like it. I do like it. And I am on board. I was just noting that. I was like, wow. Oof, that feels like a lot. At the same time, I keep forgetting it's, you know, I'm actually on that journey.
Yeah.
Can I quickly pop a little anecdote in there that you can kill or not kill as you wish? But I remember, so doing my first uni degree was social ecology, so how humans integrate with the environment. And I was surrounded all the time by all different sort of greeny, lefty type things, and which suited me because I was in that world a lot. And I remember feeling really, you know, God, nothing we're doing is making any difference. You know, this has been, you know, this was in the very early 2000s when I was doing that. And I thought, you know, for, since the 60s, people have been hugging trees and it's making no bloody difference. And I was getting all frustrated about it. And then I was out at the pub one night and just talking to some guy who I thought was relatively hot. And he was in the army, which worried me. But he was talking about his, he was saying, oh, it's just a bloody drag at the moment because, you know, when we're out in the tanks, we have to now bloody drive around any tree that's bigger than this. And, you know, he puts his hands up in a circle and goes, any tree that's bloody bigger than this, we've got to drive around it. We can't just run into it anymore. And I went, what? He said, yeah, well, bloody greenies, you know, they've all put in enough policies now that we can't just run. Like, and if we're digging in, it has to be 50 meters away from the riverbed. We can't just do it. And I was just dying laughing, just going, wow, this is awesome. This is the best news I've heard for eons. Just going, well, I didn't realize that the army now has policies that they can't run over trees of a certain width. And I just went, well, I mean, that's a tiny thing. And it's maybe not saving all the trees that I wish were saved, but it was beautiful. Just going, ah, oh, those little steps that people keep making and chipping away at are slowly and too slowly for my impatient desires, but slowly but surely getting somewhere. So I found that lovely. And I often think about it still and just go, oh, maybe there's a little tree process somewhere that's working in the right direction.
I love it. It's like environmentally responsible tank play.
Exactly.
to your point, Emma, when I stop and think about it, I've seen evidence that we are slowly moving in this direction. And I've talked about that in previous episodes as well. I think just hearing it all at once, that's a bit overwhelming, even though I know this is a part of what we are doing to help this along. But yeah, it just feels like,
I mean, you're absolutely right, Inga. It's big. And maybe as you were speaking, I was reminded how it must have felt to those early revolutionary, and again, I mean that with respect, feminists in the 1950s, the level of change that they were staring down, and oh, look at how much they have achieved.
Mm.
But I think you were right. It is big. And the larger the organization or the larger the team, the slower the change process is. So if it's just, say, the three of us having a conversation about something, we've got the capacity to change pretty quickly. If we were having a conversation around who wants to do the childcare and how we're going to sort that out, if you imagine we're in some kind of family or community situation, because there's only three of us, we can get through that relatively quickly. And inner work process is even quicker. You can just decide to do something differently and it's done. That's all there is to it. Scale that up. The bigger the organization, the slower the change process. And I actually think this is even bigger than you imagine it to be, Inga. I would like to zoom out one further layer before finally retreating back to my personal story around this. So, yeah, I think there's an even bigger perspective here. I think that what's trying to happen here through all of this, this conversation and the various gender movements and everything else, I don't think it's just about gender equality or gender justice or gender issues. I think all of those things are absolutely important. But I think that what this is really about is the survival and evolution of our species.
Oh, is that all?
No, it's bigger than that. It's possible. I'm sorry, I just love this so much. I don't even know if this will make it, survive the edit, but I love the audacity of this. It is possible that we are here on planet Earth, we and the other species, it's possible that we are the only life that has ever existed. So as Fermi asked, you know, if the stats on other life forms and other cultures and aliens and so forth are so high, then where are they? It is possible that this is the only life that has ever and will ever exist in this thing, the universe, the galaxy, whatever. And we as humans, we have the power to destroy all of that life or at least savagely alter them. And our evolution might relate very directly to the survival of all life that has ever existed. So we may in fact be the gods. To survive to this point, it has served us well to occupy a certain point on a scale which has got selfishness on one end and pro-social behaviour on the other end of that scale. I would say that as a species, so I'm looking back through the family tree to chimps, monkeys, and sort of that whole section, and then going back even further than that, I would say that there's a lot of selfishness in our behavior patterns. So our desire to keep ourselves alive at most other costs has served us well. And you can see that, you can see in the way that chimps or protecting ourselves or possibly those that are immediately around us, so our family or our tribe or our group or however you want to call that. You can see that in the way chimps protect their turf, which in turn protects their DNA. I am no kind of expert, but it seems to me that you can see that same behavior in tribal relations all around the world, Americas, Australia, Africa. You see like conflict between tribes, but preservation of your own. And huge apologies for inaccuracies of that observation. You can also see it when you scale up to the very concept of a nation state or a country. I mean, that's nothing but a name and that's nothing but a way of separating us from another group. There's no other differences in most cases. Things like slavery is only possible if you've got an us and them mentality, if you can work out a way to separate those other people from you. And we've got more slavery now than ever. You can even see it in stuff like football and the other sports balls, like choosing a team and locking onto them and following them and getting a passionate hatred about all other teams. That's just exactly the same mechanism, which has served us really well as a species. So it's an us versus them mentality, and it's a power over mentality. It's about using our brawn rather than our brains, and it's about bullying. It's a model that features terrifyingly strong leadership and the willingness to kill other people and other species in order to survive. So as I say, there is a lot of selfishness in our model, in my opinion. But I think where we find ourselves now is that we have so compellingly won the race that our competitive and selfish instinct may now be the thing that kills us, or at least halts our next evolution. So if you look at our situation at the moment, we don't just hunt animals anymore. We fucking well farm them.
Right.
We don't just eat vegetables. We genetically create them. We're at the stage where instead of making our own shelters, we're on our way to having machines that print them for us. And we used to use stories and spoken word to pass on our knowledge from one generation to the next. And as of 2023, it's likely we stored more information in that 1 year than the previous 1 million years.
Wow. It's a lot.
It's a lot. So as we sit at this moment, we're on the cusp of having artificial intelligence that is smarter than us, and robots that will do our work for us. Compared to the lives that came before us, our lives will seem endless, if they're not actually endless. And we need to remember that all of that technology is not separate to us. That's all a part of our evolution. In the same way that we developed bigger brains, you can argue that having computers in our pockets and servers on the bottom of the ocean to keep them cool, that's a part of our evolution as a species. We're just continuing to expand those incredible brains.
Outsourcing our brains.
Yeah. So, our evolution is no longer something that's just in our DNA as people. It's in our technology and our culture and our wealth. And I think that being selfish has been really important in getting us to this position, but it is collaboration and compassion that will help us to survive from here going forwards.
I guess it's the age old, what do you do if you don't have to fight to survive anymore?
Yeah. Yeah.
And is that what all this is pointing to?
Yes. 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 And if we do just keep fighting to survive, we easily have the capacity to wipe everything off the planet at the moment. So we want to kind of rein it in. So when we look at the gender movements that we've been talking about in this episode, most of them fit that selfish model. They've been a sort of an us and them. They've been built around an us and them kind of a model. So the patriarchy was for men. Feminism has mostly been for women. The men's movement, the incels, the alt-right, pickup artists, mostly for men. The minority gender movements are mostly for themselves, for very understandable reasons, in all cases. So we can stay in that fight until things run out. The pendulum will swing forever if it can, and revolutions will go on forever if they can. Or we can evolve. This comes to your comment, Inga, about big and change takes time. It does, but evolution no longer takes thousands of generations and millennia of years. Thanks to the fact that most of our evolution is now social and most of our culture is as simple to change as saying something differently or making a different decision, we can evolve right here, right now. And I'm going to show you what it looks like. So here's what it looks like for me. I care about everyone. I care about women and women's issues, and that does not make me a misandrist. I care about men and men's issues, and that does not make me a misogynist. I care about minority genders and their issues, and that care doesn't come at the expense of the other genders. If someone says something negative or makes a joke about someone else's gender, I will speak up if I can. And I care about you and the issues that impact on you because of your sex or gender. Feminism dared to wonder if we could undo our social conditioning. I think the answer is fuck yes, we can. And I believe that that is the righteous path. But to only think about this in terms of one's own gender, I think is to not go the whole way with that question. I think the question is, can we undo the social conditioning that encourages us to only think of ourselves and our immediate group? Can we go beyond borders, beyond brand allegiance, beyond football teams, beyond our immediate families, beyond our political parties, beyond gender, and beyond polarization? Can we have conversations with our partners around who's going to parent? Can we invite other genders into what used to be gender separate spaces? Can we see people as individuals rather than as their genders? Can we recognize there's always more to the story and we can hold two truths at the same time? Can we recognize that we're all privileged and not privileged, and that we're all victims and perpetrators? I believe we can. Thank you for being a part of Pan Political. I warned you it was big.
You know you're asking for the end of competition.
Yeah, that's all.
Yeah. Can you put competition aside? Can you put aside the want to be competitive in anything? Because that's what you're actually asking.
Yeah. And it's a gross oversimplification, but if you look at this as being on a spectrum from sharp one end of the scale and pro-social at the other end, not only can you put us as a collective entire species somewhere on that spectrum, but as individuals, we're all in slightly different spots on that spectrum. And rather than eyeing off more selfishness, so more worth for ourselves, more advantage at the expense of other people, rent, etc., can we instead look in the other direction? And it's there as a part of us, because we also could not have got here if we were not pro-social. If we didn't care about other people, we would have also come asunder and we wouldn't have gotten this far without that quality. Right, I think that now that we seem to have mastered the basic survival question, the next survival question is collaboration.
It's what you do in an abundant society is you share the abundance.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm.
Fun.
Isn't it? All right. Shall I move on to my personal conclusion?
Sure.
Okay. So for me personally, it's intensely gratifying to get this out. And now's a moment to say to the two of you, thank you for participating in this and helping me to facilitate this and playing along with this, humoring me, being engaged or engrossed by this, wherever you are on that scale. I really appreciate you both for lending your voices and your brains and your hearts to this topic and this material. It's really touching.
Thank you. It's been a total honour.
It has. Hearing what you've put together over many, many years and being allowed to be a part of that is amazing.
Yeah.
More than a part of it, you've helped facilitate it.
Yay.
Yay.
Collaboration. What?
Yeah. Oh, it's so true. So it's been really gratifying for me to do and get it out. It's given me so much hope to be able to speak to these topics. I know how it's going to go down. I've been here enough before. So some are going to absolutely hate and loathe it. I don't imagine that those people will have survived this far through the series. But yeah, if your belief is that locking on hard to one side of the story and being right is important to you, then you're going to hate most things about this. If you believe in just one gender's issues alone, then you're going to hate this. And if you get your energy from rage and anger at other people, you're going to hate this. I believe that most people that listen to this will love it, or at least love parts of it. or at least see that the overall intention is solid and supportable, even if we're going to disagree on various bits of the detail. There's absolutely no chance that every bit of detail on this could be correct. So yeah, I have heard in my meanderings, and particularly since I started playing around with the idea of pan-political over the last maybe 10 years or so, I've heard back from far too many people that this perspective has been life-changing for them, and in some cases, life-saving for them to just have this perspective and to be validated in these ways. And I also know that people will talk about it behind the scenes extensively. Yeah, for me, I don't know. I hope that somewhere in this there's a contribution to a better approach to gender politics and a better world. This is the one thing left on my bucket list. And now it's done.
Yay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for being brave enough to dive into such murky water. You know, you were just thanking us for being part of it, but I've loved being able to be part of it because for me personally, I ride myself and feel like I have a better life when I'm not fixed in a position. I feel like my life is more vibrant and more amazing when I can actively feel fluidity and newness and curiosity, and that's where I feel growth. So personally, like, that's how that works for me. And so being able to be part of something where I go, I've got no idea what the answer is or whether there is an answer. In some of the cases, I didn't even know where I stood on particular things before we started talking about them. And some of them I still don't know. And I love that.
Yeah, nice.
And I personally really value not knowing, but I also know it's scary as fuck for some people. Most people, me included, the not knowing is quite scary.
And yeah.
And it's easy to just back away from it, go, oh, too hard. I'm going to leave that one be. It's really easy to do that.
There's a perceived or actual sense of safety in certainty. So even if that just means locking onto a thing, at least you know where you stand on something.
Yeah.
This is an invitation into the unknown.
Okay.
It's like, what if we scramble that entire picture up and throw all the cards in the air?
Yeah.
I don't know exactly how they're going to land. And as I say, there's no chance that all of this is correct.
It's already driven me to have some of those conversations. Like, as we explore things, I've talked to people about some of the stuff, either directly about the kind of things that we've talked about, or being able to take some of those concepts into, well, what if that space was not just for women? What if we opened that up to anyone who wanted to? And in fact, some of our biggest deniers, what if we actually encouraged them to do that in spite of that, because they have a different point of view, and being exposed to some of the concepts that we're covering or for one gender should actually be across all, and to see if they can share their experiences, because I suspect they have the same experiences and that's why they really, really are so upset that they're not getting that opportunity. Yeah.
Wow. Wow.
So, yeah, you're already spreading the word.
I know it's given me a lot of hope in a world where I sometimes feel impotent, and also helped me get in touch with the same value that I would never expect a woman to tolerate a man or anyone in their life that refused to have an interest in their issues and the ways that they're negatively impacted. And it's helped me to get in touch with, it's not good for me to be in a world or to have people around me who refuse to have any interest in the issues that affect me. And I like what I'm winding up with in that process.
You deserve better.
I can't think of a better spot to end. Thank you.
Thanks.
I'm recording a live show, and I'd love to have you there. It's going to be for a follow-up episode to this pan-political series, where I'll be putting out some additional content and responding to some feedback that I've received, including your questions and comments on the day. It'll be somewhere between a workshop and a presentation, meaning you'll have the opportunity to chat with other listeners about your thoughts in the series, and it'll be a bit interactive. It'll be a nice, chilled-out way to hang out with me and some other interesting listeners for a couple of hours. It'll be by Zoom, so you don't even need to leave home, on the morning of Saturday the 5th of July 2025 in Australia time, which is the evening of Friday the 4th of July in US time. It's really cheap, around 15 or 20 bucks, and even cheaper if you're a Patreon member. Links are in the show notes for this live recording and also on the Curious Creatures website. Like I say, I'd love to see you there and to meet you. I'm running a course called A Therapist's Guide to Sexuality, Taboos and Kink with Process Work International. It's designed with therapists in mind, by which I mean any one-to-one practitioner who wants to know more about the world of sexuality so as to be able to better support your clients that are exploring that world. It'll tackle a whole bunch of juicy topics, like how to pick positively and therapeutically beneficial forms of play from ones that might be damaging or concerning. It addresses why people pursue these areas of interest in the first place, and what you can do to support them towards safe and well-paced experimentation, even if you yourself have got little or no interest in such things. The course is pitched at therapists of various descriptions, but will also be of relevance to people seeking a solid grounding in best practice exploration of their sexuality. It runs for 3 2-hour sessions by Zoom, starting on September the 9th, 2025. Links are in the show notes, and also on the Curious Creatures website. Love to see you there. How about that capitalism, huh? I want to talk with you about a weird way that capitalism is actually kind of functional. It's to do with this podcast. Firstly, I want to stress it's okay for you to just listen to this and not contribute. I say just listen because it's not nothing. By just listening to it, you're engaging with my material, you're probably having chats about it with others, and really, that's all I'm doing this for. I can tell that you are there because I can see you in the total number of downloads, and it means a lot to me. This relationship works for me. It's okay to just listen. At the same time, I know that some of you want to show a more active level of support and are in a position to do so. This is where capitalism comes into it and doesn't actually do a half bad job. I've set up a Patreon page, which, in short, is an easy way for you to contribute. And it's very meaningful to me. I used to be sceptical about paying for podcasts, but eventually I had to ask myself how it differs from paying for books, or for videos, or for workshops, or for therapy, all of which I pay for pretty consistently. And this, my friends, is my version of a book, or a workshop, or a whatever. So I feel okay about asking for a donation through Patreon, if you're in a position to do so, and this has been meaningful for you. So the link is in the show notes and also on the Curious Creatures website. If you're not in a position to contribute, please don't feel guilty about listening to this for free. I appreciate you, and I appreciate having you on this ride with me.